This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail? Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. November is Men's Health Awareness Month, so Talkspace wants guys to know that being prepared for life's biggest challenges and opportunities means prioritizing mental health, too. Talkspace can help you go beyond fine-tuned workouts, supplements, and productivity hacks. Talkspace can help you fine-tune your inner life so you can succeed in being the best version of yourself in any situation. And with Talkspace, you can get therapy from anywhere and on your time. You can even text your therapist between sessions. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace takes most insurance, and most insured members have a $0 copay. Men's Health Awareness Month is the perfect time to reach out to Talkspace. Now, get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com. That's Talkspace.com, promo code SPACE80.
Hey, everybody. Today we're debating whether or not the Big Bang reveals God, and we are starting right now with the no side in particular, and with Phil, per se. Thanks for being with us, Phil. The floor is all yours for your opening.
Well, I'd like to thank Hugh for this debate. His book, The Creator of the Cosmos, makes the opposite claim of our book, Battle of the Big Bang. Hugh writes, quote, "If the universe arose out of a Big Bang, it had a beginning. If it had a beginning, it must have had a beginner," close quote. But in our book, we distinguish between the hot Big Bang, a theory, and our book being the Battle of the Big Bang, by the way, we distinguish between, one, the hot Big Bang, a theory that says the universe evolved from a hot, dense state and makes no claims about a beginning of time, and two, the Big Bang singularity, which is the idea of an infinitely dense beginning. Hugh uses evidence for the hot Big Bang, then switches to a conclusion about a singularity, a singularity most cosmologists actually reject. In multiple surveys, physicists show a strong majority that the Big Bang should be defined only as the hot Big Bang, rejecting the Big Bang singularity. So Hugh's claim that the Big Bang implies a beginning contradicts mainstream science. Now, it's true that Penrose-Hawkins singularity theorems can be used to argue for a beginning, and Hugh claims they require only two assumptions. Mass exists and general relativity governs cosmic dynamics. Now, this is false. There are other assumptions that we describe in our book. Hugh also argues that because general relativity has been confirmed so well, and because we currently observe mass to exist, the theorems are, quote, "no longer in question," close quote. But they are in question. Skipping over some of the assumptions that Hugh leaves out, the fact that mass exists now does not mean it was present in the extreme conditions of the Big Bang. Penrose himself suggests this is false. Moreover, quantum mechanics, the physics of the very small, is at least as well tested as general relativity, the physics of the very big, if not more so. But these two theories contradict each other. At the Big Bang, we need to combine both in a quantum theory of gravity. Many attempts to model the Big Bang using candidate quantum gravity theories imply it was not the beginning. Now, they may be wrong, but without a verified theory of quantum gravity, we cannot be confident the Big Bang was the beginning. Now, Hugh writes, quote, "Scientists who are opposed to Christianity will admit that overwhelming observational evidence affirms the universe had a beginning," close quote. But this is false. Scientists accept overwhelming evidence for the hot Big Bang, not for a Big Bang singularity. Many Christian cosmologists reject Hugh's claims. Don Page is one example. He says, quote, "We simply do not know whether the universe had a beginning." George Ellis and Richard Gott are other prominent Christian cosmologists who have suggested the universe might have no beginning. He also appeals to the Borda-Guth-Wilenkin theorem about inflation, that's a proposed period of extremely rapid cosmic expansion. He quotes Alex Wilenkin as saying it proves the universe had a beginning. And Wilenkin did say that in a popular book. But another author of the theorem, Alan Guth, clarifies that it, quote, means inflation must have had a beginning. It doesn't really say the universe must have had a beginning, close quote. Even Wilenkin now acknowledges this, saying the theorem proves that inflation must have a beginning. Quote, the universe as a whole, it doesn't. The theorem doesn't say that, close quote. Wilenkin also said of the picture he defends of a universe evolving from a singularity, quote, that picture I don't think anybody believes, close quote. To make matters worse for Hugh, recent papers suggest the Borda-Guth-Wilenkin theorem has a mistake. But even if the theorem is valid, models like a bouncing universe avoid it. For example, loop quantum gravity, a leading proposal for quantum gravity, predicts a maximum density. Once reached, gravity becomes repulsive and the universe bounces. Scalar field models like Kuskaton can also modify Einstein's equations at high energy and trigger a bounce. Now, Hugh's reply to this is to say that loop quantum gravity is, quote, a radical, untestable hypothesis, close quote. But it's conservative compared to string theory and requires no extra dimensions, the very extra dimensions Hugh ironically invokes to explain God. He also claims loop quantum gravity predicts something called Lorentz violation, and that experimental data disproves this. But that's just wrong. Loops don't predict this, and even those quantum gravity theories that do don't expect current experiments to see it. Moreover, Hugh is contradicting himself. If experiments can rebut these theories, they can't be untestable. His errors continue with scalar fields. Hugh writes that a scalar field is a force or an energy term, and even claims, quote, gravity is a scalar field, close quote. Both are incorrect. He says, quote, cosmic scalar fields leaves the singularity theorem unchallenged, close quote. Yet the Kuskaton model that Niasch helped develop removes the singularity entirely. So Hugh is wrong yet again. Now, another argument for a beginning is the second law of thermodynamics. Entropy always increases. So if the universe were eternal, it should already be at maximum entropy. Since it isn't, there must have been a beginning. But this assumes that maximum entropy is finite. If it's infinite, the argument falls apart. Alan Guth recently lectured on this, suggesting that an infinite entropy universe can explain the arrow of time in a way a finite entropy universe cannot. And he claims that the universe is likely past eternal as a result. Now, I'm not saying he is right, but rather I want to stress the uncertainty over whether the universe had a beginning. And there I'll hand it over to Niyesh.
Thank you, Phil. So, but if the universe did begin, does it require a beginner? According to Hugh, quote, causes precede their effects. But if time begins with the universe, there is no before for a cause to operate. If the universe needs a cause, why doesn't God? Some reply that God was timeless before creation, so he does not need a cause. But the universe could also have been timeless before creation, and so it shouldn't need a cause either. In our book, we outline models, one of which I worked on, holographic cosmology, suggesting exactly that. Hugh, however, appeals to an extra time dimension and claims the universe must, or quote, must have more than four dimensions. But extra dimensions are speculative, so to say they must exist is misleading. And if God can avoid a cause that way, the universe can too. Indeed, in our book, we outline a model of the Big Bang with this very feature, again, a model I developed with my colleagues. Most importantly, there is no observational evidence for a singularity, nor any prospect for this, as singularities make no predictions. That is the problem with singularities. We cannot measure infinite density, nor is there observational evidence for what happened before inflation, if inflation happened at all. Hugh claimed evidence of complex inflation is evidence of God. To show this, he appeals to a cosmological number called NS. Don't worry about what this is, but matters is that Hugh claims that if this number is greater than one, inflation is ruled out, that simple models imply it's 0.95, and complex models predict between 0.95 and 0.97. He then quotes observers showing it's 0.965, and concludes therefore, quote, there is less than one chance in six quintillion that the universe did not experience an inflation event very early in its history, end quote. This is wrong on so many levels. Mistake number one, there are simple inflationary models compatible with NS equal to 0.965. For example, the first model of inflation developed by Stravinsky in 1980. Mistake number two, there are non-inflationary models that produce the same value. For example, the bithermal Big Bang model that I've co-developed with my colleagues. Mistake number three, there are inflationary models that give NS greater than one. For example, hybrid models with two fields. Mistake number four, there are simple inflationary models that give NS greater than 0.97. Why does this matter? Perhaps you want inflation to look more confirmed than it is, because many alternatives to inflation suggest the Big Bang was not the beginning. But this strategy is also confused because inflation itself is a pre-Big Bang model. Alan Guth himself, one of the creators of inflation, now calls it a prequel to the hot Big Bang, as Phil mentioned. Moreover, new measurements from the Atacama Desert and the South Pole may suggest NS is higher than 0.97. Will Hugh's confidence in God diminish as a result? I doubt it, because Hugh has said, quote, "We should never allow science to trump the Bible," end quote. So he's saying no evidence would allow him to overturn his belief in the Bible. That's the biggest divide between us. We assess theories in science by what predictions they make, giving them up if the data contradicts those predictions. The singularity Hugh appeals to makes no predictions, and it's treated with a skepticism by the scientific community, even its authors, Penrose and Hawking. So we cannot be confident the universe had a beginning, and even if it did, there is no reason to think God began it. Thus, the Big Bang provides no evidence for God. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, James, you're muted.
Thank you very much. Folks, we are thrilled to have you here. let me just check. There it is. Thanks very much, folks, for being with us today. If you're new to Modern Day Debate, I'm your host, Dr. James Koons. We are thrilled to have our guests. We really do appreciate them. And we also want to let you know, housekeeping, things coming up. Tomorrow, DebateCon 6, our two-day debate conference starts. Check out the link below for tickets, or if you want to watch it live, check out our channel memberships. With that, we're going to kick it over to Dr. Hugh Ross. We're grateful to have you here with us, Dr. Ross, and the timer is set for your 10-minute opening as well.
Well, thank you, and this is our second dialogue we've had with one another, and I'm grateful for this one because I thought we kind of talked past one another in the first one. And so, and, you know, I really enjoyed the book that the two of you wrote. Every model you presented, I think, is compatible with the Christian faith. Some of the models, I think, are a problem with other religious beliefs, and I concur with what you've done there. And, you know, I think you wrote the book just for people who are interested in the astrophysics of the Big Bang, letting people know there are many different Big Bang models. But you made a statement in the book that tells me this is a book that has broader impact than just physics and astronomy. I mean, you made a comment on page 301, "The quest to understand our ultimate origins burns deeply within us all." And I would agree with that statement. We're the one species of life on planet Earth that's even concerned about these things. But it raises a question. Where did this quest come from? And why are we the only species that has this quest? But the bottom line is, I think the models that you've reviewed are of real importance to philosophers and theologians. So I've already been recommending your book to my theological peers. And, you know, in one sense, I think what I would add to that is that when you actually look at the universe we observe, it becomes clear that we humans existed a unique time in cosmic history where we can actually observe nearly the full extent of cosmic history. And what's also compelling is we seem to be at the only location where it's possible for beings like us to be able to witness the whole history of the universe. And from my perspective as a Christian, I don't think that's an accident. I think the creator of the universe wanted us to have this full capability of reading the book of nature from beginning to end. And for me personally, your book was deja vu because years ago, I was participating in a conference at Cambridge University. It featured eight physicists and eight theologians. All of us were Christians, but the way the week worked out, each of us had to debate one of our peers, and we also had to debate somebody who is not our peer. So I had to debate John Polkinghorne on the physics of the universe, and then I had to debate William Lane Craig, a philosopher. But the theme of the conference was God, eternity, and time. And what we're doing at the conference is, first of all, what does the Bible mean by a cosmic beginning? And some of the ideas that were thrown out, this is when the laws of physics and the cosmic space-time dimensions become fixed, or it's a time when the cosmic expansion began, a time when the universe began to cool, or it was a time when our detection capabilities ceased to yield unambiguous information about the universe. And then there are several of us who thought, well, I think all of these apply. But as I read your book, I noted all the models that you are presenting fit into those categories that we had agreed upon at the conference at Cambridge. And, you know, I'm quite a bit older than the two of you, but your book was deja vu for another reason, because we are all at Caltech. Rich Gott, Don Page, and I were at Caltech at the same time. And a lot of the conversations we had over lunch, over dinner, were along the lines of what's in your book. And by the way, we would refer to Rich as Richard because he didn't obey the Caltech dress code. He always came in a suit and tie. The rest of us were in shorts and t-shirts. So, but I noticed you call him Rich rather than Richard. That was our nickname for him. We called him Richard because he had this formal demeanor. I'm curious of whether that's still the case now that he's quite a bit older in years. But yes, we would recognize the fact that the beginning of the universe is not the beginning of all things. I mean, it says repeatedly in the Bible that God began his works of redemption, his conquest of evil, before he created anything at all. And you know, I've had a lot of debates with Christians where they talk about, hey, what is the beginning of the universe? And it's like, hey, whenever you see this in the Bible, you need to ask the question, the beginning of what? And this all falls in line. I mean, the reason why we physicists and philosophers came up with these, what we thought were good markers, what the Bible means about the cosmic beginning, is based on Hebrews 11:3. The universe we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. And what I noticed in your book, you kept talking about how all Big Bang models have their issues and their problems, which is why we got such a fertile debate going on. But I think one reason for that is when you get before the beginning of the cooling of the universe, or when you delve, say, before cosmic inflation, or the different models you present that are alternatives to inflation, you're in a realm where your observations are not going to give you unambiguous conclusions about the state of the universe. So I think I'd agree with you. All these models have their problems, and there's a limit to what we can do to solve all these problems. What I really appreciated about the book is that you actually looked at several places where we can probably push a little farther than we're able to push so far. I mean, Nyesh, you mentioned, hey, what about measurements we can make on the scalar spectral index? I think that's got some possibility. Although, like you, I'm not all that hopeful that any measurements there are going to distinguish between what's going on before the beginning of inflation and cooling. And I think, personally, we may be able to get a handle by looking at what we see in black hole physics, black hole population statistics, the mergers of neutron stars to make black holes. I think that's got the possibility to explore possible new physics. You did mention the Hubble tension. I think that's got some possibilities of being able to tell us what's going on. You know, what's happening with stars that are orbiting the supermassive black hole, the center of our galaxy. So, and, you know, are there ways that we can test modified Newtonian dynamics with respect to what general relativity predicts? So I think that has probably more possibilities of fruitful outcomes than trying to explore, okay, what happens when you let the laws of physics change, the velocity of light change, or you bring in extra dimensions of space and time. But yeah, a lot of what we discussed at the Cambridge conference was, you know, there seems to be a beginning to length, width, height, and time, but there could be other dimensions at play here. And we see from a Christian perspective, God, from a Christian's perspective, has created different dimensional realms. So I think you make a good point. We have to be open to those possibilities. And but again, all this is, and I also think looking at the end of the universe might give us some insights what's happening at the beginning of the universe. And so, and the Bible actually addresses this, although only in three places, where it talks about God wrapping up, you know, the space-time dimensions like a scroll and everything ending in a fiery heat. There's a number of models that actually would predict something like that, and that might tell us something about the beginning of the universe. And I think God gave us just as strong a curiosity about the end as he did about the beginning. So I think we need to explore both possibilities. And Phil, I kind of agree with your critiques of what I've written. You know, a lot of what I've been writing is for a lay audience. I think what you're pointing out, hey, if you're talking to cosmologists, especially theoretical cosmologists, you need to be really careful with your caveats. And I thought you did a really good job with that in your book. And just so you're aware, I agree with everything you wrote in your book. And so you basically have been giving me kind of a signal, hey, probably good in your lay level books to make it a lot more clear where the boundaries are, where the caveats are. Lay audiences typically are interested in those things. That's one reason why I'm recommending your book. You actually lay that out very carefully. I also appreciate, you know, your book is basically about debate, Big Bang debates. And, you know, I've been involved in some of those debates where they're not very gracious. And I want to commend the two of you. You really made the debate gracious, which is where I think we need it to be. And that's one thing that impressed me at the Cambridge conference. Even though there was all these debates going on, all the debates were gracious. And basically, we're trying to push one another. Okay, what more can we learn about the universe than we know right now? And what more can we learn about God and his actions before he created the universe, given that we have a fairly significant challenge defining what is that creation, what is the beginning? Again, Hebrews 11:3, the universe we can detect did not come than what we can detect. And yeah, my 10 minutes is up.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for those opening statements. We'll jump into the open dialogue and want to let you know, folks, we're going to, just to make sure it's right down the middle in terms of fairness with time, we're going to have 2-minute segments during the open discussion. So I'm going to set the timer for 2 minutes, and it's up to, in the case of Phil or Nyayesh, you guys are welcome to choose, of course, who will have this first 2 minutes, and then we'll go over to Dr. Ross for 2 minutes.
Right.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'll go start, yeah. Okay, well, first of all, thank you, Hugh, for all your kind words about our book. It's really, really kind of you to say that, and we really, really appreciate it. I think it'd be good to clarify, rather than me just go for 2 minutes, it'd be good to clarify, because in your, you say, well, I'm talking to a lay audience, and I say there's a beginning of the universe, but hey, when I'm talking to theoretical cosmologists, we need to put all these caveats in that it's more uncertain. But my concern is that when you speak to a lay audience, you do make the point that the beginning of the universe has been proven. I mean, you quoted Vilenkin as saying the universe has been proven. I've got another quote from here in your book, and you said, quote, what was needed to solidify the proof of the beginning of time was evidence that general relativity does tell the true story of the dynamics of the universe. And then you go on to say, you know, that the evidence for relativity has, quote, has laid to rest any nagging doubts about Einstein's equation of general relativity, and therefore the space-time theorems, which I presume you mean singularity theorems, are no longer in question. And then you've got this whole book basically saying, well, this is then strong evidence for God, because as you said, if the Big Bang happened and it had a beginning and it needs a beginner. But what we're saying, and it seems to me that you're actually agreeing, is that actually the Big Bang doesn't imply the beginning. And I think it's really profound for you to say that. So it'd be really good if you can just clear up. Do you want to walk back what you said in your book, Cosmos and Creator, and not just in your book, you've said it in many, many speeches. Now, another thing that you said was that, well, every model in our book is compatible with Christianity. And that's worrying, because you also say that your theorems, your creation model makes predictions. And it predicts that the universe should have a beginning. But many of the models that we examine in our book, the universe does not have a beginning. You also say that we're in a unique position to observe all of cosmic history. But if you're right that inflation happened, and maybe it did, maybe it didn't, but if it did happen, then most theorists in inflation cosmology would say inflation is eternal. So in fact, we would not be able to observe all of cosmic history. Yeah. If inflation didn't happen and there was a bounce,
correct.
Well, we may not be able to observe that either.
Well, we could get over to Dr. Ross for 2 minutes as well.
Yeah, I think what you're bringing up is we have to carefully define what is the Big Bang and what is the beginning. And again, this is something we debated at length at Cambridge. It's something that Rich and Don Page and I did talk about, is that when the Bible talks about beginning, beginning of what? And so I think we do have a very strong observational evidence. There's a beginning to the cosmic cooling. There's a beginning to when the laws of physics become constant and the space-time dimensions become fixed. These are statements that the Bible states. I think what's compelling to me, I wasn't raised in a Christian home, and Christianity was the last religion I studied. But what impressed me is the Bible was the only ancient book that predicted several of the fundamental features of Big Bang cosmology. But I think what you address in your book is people mean different things about the Big Bang. And so the reason why I say your book is very compatible with Christianity, I'm recommending it to Christian philosophers and Christian theologians, is that you're actually making statements in the book. Okay, there really is a beginning to the cooling of the universe. There does seem to be a point where we go back in cosmic history, something like inflation happened. There's a washing out of information of what happened before then. And again, that's right in line with what you see in Hebrews chapter 11. So I think this is going to be valuable because often we Christians are a little bit loose when we talk about beginning. I mean, again, I've had debates with young earth creationists where they would actually quote Mark 10 as proof that the beginning was the same time as Adam. But what they're not recognizing, Mark 10 says nothing about the universe. It's all about the beginning of human marriage. That's just another example of the beginning of what?
We'll kick it over to the other side.
Up to you, gentlemen. Maybe I can go now. So I actually had the breakfast with Rich a couple of weeks ago. He's doing well. I think he still wears his suit. He's called it the quote from the future. right. Very good. So I think this is amazing, and it's very interesting point of view that you say that every model of the Big Bang is consistent with the Bible. Every model of Big Bang that we discussed. So the way your reprieve is that you can define beginning in the proper way for that to happen, and then that kind of begs the question that if we could reinterpret Bible in any way we want, then why do we really want to seek evidence for God in science? You could, of course, do that, but do we learn much or do we gain much? What do we gain from this exercise? I think that is really my question for you, that because science is something that's ever changing and it's very critical, but your belief in Bible is a constant. So why do we want to kind of bother and seek further proof for that in science?
Well, the Bible makes it clear that there's a place where we're not going to be able to detect things, that the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. But we can detect a lot. And, we can go back 13.79 billion years. I mean, we are stopped when light begins to come out of the space-time curvature. That seems to be the point where it's very difficult to probe any earlier. Although you make points in your book, there are possibilities where we may be able to probe a little bit. We're not going to learn everything, but from a biblical perspective, the past 13.79 billion years of cosmic cooling and cosmic expansion, those are open for exploration. And we can use those observations to test whether or not the Bible got it right, whether or not the Hindu Vedas got it right, the Buddhist commentaries got it right. And that's kind of my story of how I became a follower of Jesus Christ, is realizing the Bible did make these specific predictions. And the predictions it made about the past history of the universe, they're borne out as being correct, where I can't say the same thing for religions that compete with the Bible. They make statements that we can prove are clearly incorrect. So
maybe just I get a little bit of clarification in this. What observation in the past, I don't know, 50 years or so, if it turned out differently, you would have not believed Bible. You said that Bible predicted this, but observations see this other thing, so that means Bible was wrong. Is there any such observation you would have kind of?
Yes, I mean, I had a debate like that a few years ago with the Oxford chemist, Peter Atkins, where I pointed out, hey, the Bible's quite clear that as long as we have the universe in existence as the Bible defines it, and the life in the universe, we've got laws of physics that do not change. And so the constancy of the laws of physics, the fixity of the laws of physics, is a biblical prediction. If that were to prove to be incorrect, that would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. The Bible also makes it clear that God has created a wide diversity of life, but that we human beings are exceptional. And if science were to prove that we were not exceptional, that there really is no distinction between us, say, and Homo erectus, that would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. So what happened in that debate, I gave a long list of things that the Bible predicts about the record of nature, and if any of those were proven incorrect, that indeed would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. On the other hand, if those proved to be correct, that would be strong evidence for the Christian faith, especially when you got the Bible predicting future scientific discoveries thousands of years in advance of its time. I mean, you look at the order of creation events stated in the book of Job and in Genesis. If that order were to be proved to be incorrect, or if the descriptions of any of the creation events were to be proved to be incorrect, that would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. What compelled me as a young person studying different religions...
I'll give you a chance to finish up, Dr. Ross, and then...
Okay, one quick finish. Is the best I found outside of the Bible in terms of the order of events was 2 out of 14 right, whereas the Bible got a perfect score on the order and the description.
Right, so can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I don't think the order is correct. I mean, God moves over the face of the waters before he does any creating, so there's already primordial water. Then you've got plants and grasses before the sun is created. So the order just isn't correct. Also, there's a solid dome of the sky created, the firmament, the rakia. So it seems to me that the obvious thing to say is that if you take this text literally, which many Christians don't, by the way, but Hugh seems to want to do so, then it just is false. And you could look at other religious texts and say, oh, they've got amazing things right. People say of the Tao, oh, wow, isn't it amazing that they have yin and yang, and that's matter and antimatter. Of course, they weren't talking about matter and antimatter. The modern people are imposing that meaning on the text. And that's exactly what Hugh, I think, is doing when he talks about scientific miracles in the Bible. He says it talks about the laws of physics unchanging. No, it doesn't. It never mentions the laws of physics. You know, it's just, it talks about the ordinances of the heavens, basically saying there are regularities in the sky which everyone can see. So I think he's imposing a meaning on the text. And but in particular, the interpretation of the solid dome of the sky, you can look at all kinds of commentators, whether they're rabbis, ancient Christian philosophers, they all agree that the firmament is a solid dome of the sky that keeps the waters from falling on us. The world looks like a dome, the world looks like a dome, and it's blue because it's transparent, and above us are waters, and the Bible talks about windows opening up and the waters coming on us. So there are lots and lots and lots of mistakes in Genesis. Now, I'm sure he will do some sort of mental gymnastics to try and make it fit. And we can talk about that. But what's clearly going on is just as the Taoist is imposing that meaning of yin and yang, referring to matter and antimatter, so Hugh will impose a meaning on the text that is not there. You know, so if he says that bara talks about creation ex nihilo, whereas you talk to Hebrew scholars, it doesn't mean that at all. And he talks about the Hashemayim and Haaretz meaning the whole universe. Again, lots of Hebrew scholars would say, no, that's not what it means.
Yeah, Bill, it was Galileo who made the point, the biggest mistake you can make in Bible interpretation is to get the wrong frame of reference. Genesis 1:2 says that God is hovering over the surface of the waters of the early planet Earth. The water covers the whole surface, and there's darkness over the surface of the waters. And if you go to Job 38, it tells us why it's dark. God had blanketed the early earth with clouds that kept the light of the sun, moon, and stars out. And when you get to Genesis 1:16, it doesn't say that God created the sun, moon, and stars. That's when the sun, moon, and stars first become visible to creatures on the surface of the earth as distinct objects in the sky. So I'd agree with you, if you get the wrong frame of reference, Genesis 1 is teaching nothing but scientific nonsense. But if you put the frame of reference where it is in Genesis 1:2, then everything is in exactly the same order as you see in the established scientific record. And I think the principle here is, when I looked at the world's holy books, I put them all in the best possible interpretive light. I think you can discount any book if you put it in the worst possible interpretive light. But again, Galileo, his comment was, hey, if you get the wrong point of view, you're going to mess everything up. And hey, if you don't have the right starting conditions, you're going to mess everything up. I was impressed as a young astronomy student how amazing it was that Genesis 1:2 correctly identified the starting conditions of planet Earth and then takes you through these six time periods, and everything is correctly described. So, and as far as the dome, there's an online article you can read. It's free for everybody, about 40 pages long. It's called The Myth of the Ancient Heavenly Dome, basically making the point that nobody in the ancient world believed that there was a solid dome over a flat earth. This was a problem of confusing the ancients' fantasy literature with their scientific literature. So again, go online. All you need to do is put in The Myth of the Ancient Heavenly Dome. It'll pop right up and thoroughly documents why nobody in the ancient world believed that, even though it's in their fantasy literature. Just like I think it'd be a mistake today to say that, hey, look at the Flintstones.
To wrap up, I go ahead. We'll kick it over to Phil and Niyash.
Actually, do you mind if I take this one, Niyash?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. I think it's just not true at all to say that people didn't believe that there was a solid dome of the sky. This is what the Jewish Encyclopedia says. I'm going to quote them. The Hebrews regarded the earth as a plain or a hill, figured like a hemisphere swimming on waters. Over this is arched a solid vault of heaven. To this vault are fastened the lights, the stars. So slight is elevation that birds may rise to it and fly along its expanse. Close quote. The Torah.com says, the Talmud, for example, records varying opinions about the thickness of what is clearly a solid firmament. So it's just not true. Job actually says, can you join God in spreading out the skies hard as mirror of cast bronze? So that's just not right. In fact, the translation firmament in the Greek is because it's thought to be firm. Augustine in the Motions of the Heavens says that he says this name is given to indicate not that it's motionless, but that it is solid. So it's just not true to say that people didn't believe that. And Paul Celia, a biblical scholar, he says it's just too natural for people to think of the sky as something solid. The very word rakia means, you know, expanse of space, support, the vault of heaven or firmament. This is actually from a Hebrew lexicon. Regarded by the Hebrews as solid and supporting the waters above it. If it isn't solid, how would it support the waters above? That literally doesn't make sense. Now, you say that the sun appears after the creation of grasses and so on, but the Hebrew has the word for appear, but it doesn't use it. It does not use that word. It only uses the word appear for the dry land. So again, this is the mental gymnastics that I'm talking about. You're imposing a meaning on the text that is not there.
Yeah. Again, I've written extensively on this. Again, what you see in Genesis 1:14, it uses the verb hayah, let there be the sun, moon, and stars. Fourth day, the word asah, bara, yatsar, there, none of those verbs are used. And so, again, they appear in the sky. It doesn't mean they were created at that time. And again, I want you to check out this paper that's online, The Myth of the Ancient Heavenly Dome. I do agree there are theologians today trying to make this point. I mean, what has been alarming to me is ancient translations of the Old Testament were saying that there was a sky or expanse or firmament. In the last couple of decades, they're now putting the word vault in there. But I would argue that's something that's modern and is being driven by liberal theology. If you actually read the more conservative theologians, they will say, hey, this idea of submitting a vault in there, the idea that the birds are flying along the solid surface, because the birds fly in the Rakei, you know, it's the sky. And again, if you go to the book of Job, it really clarifies that what's going on in creation day two is God setting up a complex water cycle. It even mentions six different kinds of precipitation that are set up during that time.
So if I may go, Hugh, were you done with that response?
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Okay, jump very in. Good. Thank you very much. So I think kind of what it seems to me that indeed there are kind of interpretations that I think according to Phil, it looks like that they go way back and they're inconsistent with science. And then you think that they were not correct and you have your interpretations that are more in line with science. And this is, I think this is perfectly fine. The question is, as you go forward, I mean, is there one that you're going to kind of hold your hold dear or hold correct? And I think you mentioned two things, and I want to kind of let this be a record. So you said laws of physics cannot change. And then the other is that there won't be other humans or kind of if we realize that humans are not exceptional, right? And those are actually, I think, precise predictions, if you could confirm them. So one is that you said the laws of physics are fixed. So let me run something by you. That might have already been ruled out, but we can decide. So as you know, expansion of the universe is now speeding up. But as you go back in the past, it was slowing down. So gravity was attractive, but it became repulsive when dark energy dominates. So one may argue that that has already happened. The laws of physics have changed, haven't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, I know that you made that point in the book. How, you know, we're still trying to explore what's behind dark matter, what's behind dark energy. And, you know, the latest observations from Euclid seem to be telling us that it's unlikely that dark energy is governed by a single physical constant. It's going to be more complex than that. So I'm not, you know, negating the fact that we're going to discover more about physics than we know already. But things like the velocity of light, the constant that governs gravity, you know, electromagnetic constant. You know, the Bible does have, Jeremiah 33, it talks about how the people at that time were changing their mind. And God jumped in and says, I'm a God that's immutable. I don't change. As evidence, look to the laws that govern the heavens and the earth. As they don't change, I don't change. But when you get to the book of Romans in the New Testament, it does talk about a future time when the laws of physics will no longer be constant. Oh, for example, the thermodynamic law will give way to something else. But that's not going to happen until God fulfills all the purposes for why he created this universe. You know, the Bible is clear. A time will come when the universe will end. There was a beginning to this universe that we observe. And again, that we observe. I mean, what you're pointing out is there's places where we can't probe. Or it's going to be very difficult to probe. But I guess what impressed me about the Bible is that it got all the science right that we can measure and check out. And it made these bold statements thousands of years ago. And now we're showing that what the Bible actually written is correct. We're also seeing that the fine-tuning evidence gets more and more persuasive as we learn more and more about the universe.
I can kind of follow up a little bit, but I mean, I'm just doing very quick things. I just want to clarify what's going on.
Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com. That's PolicyGenius.com.
So you said that laws of physics don't change, but then you said that maybe they can change until God fulfills the purpose. And then I just presented to you, and again, you admitted that there was this evidence for the change from attractive gravity to a repulsive gravity. So I'm kind of a bit confused now. Do you think that prediction has already been refuted, the fact that the laws have changed, or what are you saying exactly?
Well, what I'm saying is that, you know, we understand well the four fundamental forces of physics. And, you know, there's a lot in the scientific literature. Hey, is it possible there's a fifth force? Or is it possible there are constants of physics we've not yet discovered? And you know, I'm open to all of that. The Bible doesn't give us a complete story, but it gives us enough of a story. And I guess what impressed me about the Bible, too, is how detailed it was. I mean, the first book I read in cosmology was by Fred Hoyle, and he made an interesting comment there. By the way, he's very much not a Christian, but he did say, what we see in the Bible about cosmology is amazing in the extent of its content. And what I discovered is the Bible says way more about cosmology than all the other holy books combined, and it's far more specific. I mean, Phil, you made the point. It's easy to engage in what I call strong concordism, where you're basically overinterpreting what you see in the books and trying to make it fit. And, you know, I've written a point making the point we need to be careful to engage in moderate concordism, not reading more into the biblical text and what's there. And, you know, there's debates going on. For example, there are Christian philosophers and theologians who say the Bible only identified three specific features of Big Bang cosmology. Others say four, some say five. But the fact that everybody agrees it at least stated three, I think is significant.
Which three of you? Sorry, which three?
Well, that there's a history to the universe where we can trace back to the beginning of the cooling of the universe, the expansion of the universe, the beginning of the constant laws of physics. So there is that kind of beginning to the universe, where the laws of physics are constant throughout the whole history, where we can observe. And that one of those laws of physics is a pervasive law of decay, aka the second law of thermodynamics. But there's a fairly vigorous debate going on. You know, 11 places the Bible talks about the universe expanding. What does it mean by this expanding? Is it a continuous expansion? I seem to believe that the Bible, because it talks about expansion in all three Hebrew verb forms, really is saying that the universe that we can observe throughout that entire period of observation indeed is continuously expanding.
Okay, so let me reply to that. I mean, there's plenty of specific stuff if you want it to be specific. Like it says the earth is sitting on pillars, and above that is water. So it's sitting, I mean, that's just obviously wrong. But of course, you're going to interpret it as saying, well, it didn't really mean that. It says the universe is expanding in the Bible. It says the sky is stretching. The sky isn't stretching. That's not what we see. It's not the sky. And of course, you say, well, I didn't mean the sky. I meant space-time. But of course, they don't mention that. So you're imposing the meaning on the text. Now, other religious texts say that as well. In the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation myth, it says that Marduk stretched out Tiamat, which is the goddess that he kills, and he stretched it out to form the sky. Now, earlier you talked about, well, I'm going to predict that the speed of light is constant, gravitational, the constant is constant. But in your book, you also appeal to string theory to get these extra dimensions for God to operate in. But string theory seems to imply that actually you could have different values for these constants of nature. So it seems to be like you're sort of being inconsistent. You say that the beginning of the universe is predicted by the Bible, but the Bible never says anything about beginning of the universe. It says when, I mean, there's different ways to interpret it. So some people might interpret it as saying in the beginning God created the universe, but other people might say when God began to create the land and the sky, because the Hebrew words are actually land, Eretz, and Hashemayim, which is the sky. So, and it's not a beginning. It's just God imposing an order on something that was chaotic before. And that chaos is represented by an ocean. And in fact, lots of other religions have this ocean that was chaotic, and the creator imposes order on it. It's really no different. So this idea that there's lots of specific predictions, I think is one, just obviously not correct. But two, as you said, when we were talking before, that you're debating other theologians about what the Bible says, and you've got theistic evolutionists and so on, young earth creationists. If they all disagree about what this Bible says, then it can't really be that there's very clear predictions. I mean, in science, you know, there was some debate about whether there were gravitational waves predicted by relativity, but within a few decades, it was very clear relativity predicts gravitational waves so that we can go and test them. But that's obviously not the case with the Bible.
Yeah, I'm arguing that it is the case. I mean, just look at Genesis 1. It lays out an order of creation events, describes what these events are. I mean, the fact that it got it all right really impressed me long before I became a follower of Jesus Christ. And I think it's crucial, before you draw a conclusion, you want to read all the relevant biblical texts before you draw a conclusion. I mean, a good example of that, you mentioned the book of Job, how it talks about this, you know, kind of a brass surface. And but if you just read two more or three verses farther on down, it's clearly talking about a metaphor where it talks about how there's this rain that comes down and the rain stops, the sky opens up, and you look up at the sky, it becomes so much that it hurts your eyes. And it uses the analogy of a polished brass surface. And when you see light reflected in the brass surface, it indeed hurts your eyes the same way it does when you look up at the sky and where the rain has just finished and the sun comes out. It will hurt your eyes. And so that's a clear example where you could take Job chapter 38 literally, but if you actually read all four verses, it becomes clear it's giving you a metaphor. So it's one example of where you really need to read the whole of the text before you draw a conclusion. And yes, the Bible does use metaphors. It even uses hyperboles. It uses parables. But it's really clear when you read the text what is meant to be taken literally and what is meant to be taken metaphorically. When Jesus said, "I am the door," he wasn't claiming to be a door jam. He was clearly making a metaphorical statement. So again, there's a reason why there's 66 books in the Bible. You need to look at all the creation texts before you draw their conclusion. That's how I engage Christians who take on different views of creation I do. I say, hey, you've got to look at all the texts. And when you do, it's clear you can't defend it from a young earth perspective.
So just one thing before I let Niyash go. Why should we believe you on that definition, on that interpretation, and not Augustine, who said it's clearly solid? I mean, do you not think Augustine read widely about the Bible? I mean, it's pretty hard to believe.
Well, again, you need to read all, you know, Augustine wrote a lot. And so there's a lot of debate. For example, did Augustine believe in a young earth? Did he believe in an old earth? It's easy to take one sentence out of Augustine's writings, as young earth creationists do, and say he's a young earth creationist. But I would argue if you read everything he said about the past history of the earth, it's really clear he's an old earth creationist. So you can always take, you know...
Right, but I wasn't arguing about that. I was arguing about whether he thinks the dome is solid, and he's very, very clearly says it's solid.
Well, I don't see that when I read Augustine. I don't see...
I'll quote it to you. He says, the name is given to indicate not that it is motionless, but that it is solid, and it constitutes an impassable boundary between the waters above and the waters below. That's Augustine.
Yeah, but what does he mean by that? Again... please read that online article about the myth of the ancient heavenly dome. It actually quotes Augustine and tries to explain what he was really saying. Again, when somebody's writing 2 million words, it's easy to pick one sentence out and basically get the wrong idea of what he believed.
So if I kind of jump in for a bit, it seems that, you have this choice that you think that these things are metaphorical and these things are literal. And you can imagine that different generations over centuries and millennia, based on their understanding of the world around them, could choose to take some parts of the Bible as literal and other parts as metaphorical. So it could be that some parts that were taken to be very literal in the past because they didn't know about many things in science, now that we understand science better, maybe we take those parts metaphorically. But then there are other parts that are maybe more consistent with the science as we know it. You take them literally. Don't you think that's what's happening?
Yeah, you're raising a point, and this has come up in debates I've had with theologians, where some, for example, think the first 11 chapters of Genesis are all allegorical, and we shouldn't be reading it historically or scientifically. In my debates with them, I said, yes, but look at the text. Look how it uses chronological clues. And there's no other passage of the Bible that has so many chronological inferences built into the text. That's not what you see in metaphorical or parabolic writing. We expect those to be missing. Or when people say, the dimensions of Noah's Ark, those are all hyperbole. Well, when I'm using hyperbole, I say my briefcase weighs a ton. But if I tell you it weighs 23.5 kilograms, you're going to interpret that as a literal statement, not as a metaphor. And so when you see the Bible giving numbers to 3 or 4 places of the decimal, I don't think that's hyperbole. I think that's literal. So again, as philologists will point out, you can look at the text itself and determine what passage should be taken literally, historically, and what passages should be taken metaphorically. When you look in, for example, Job 37 to 39, it's clear it's not giving us a chronology, but it's giving us a detailed description of the events in a non-chronological sequence. Because I run into scholars who try to read Job 37 to 39 as a chronology, but I said, notice, there's no chronological clues in the text like you do see in the first 11 chapters of Genesis.
I wonder, Hugh, if we can just go back to this issue of the beginning of the universe, because in your book, In the Cosmos and Creator, you were very, very clear that the Bible predicts an absolute beginning of time and a creation ex nihilo, right? You quote Barara saying that it means creation ex nihilo. So, but then you say that there are all the models of the universe are that we examine in our book, many of which do not have creation ex nihilo. I think only one of them actually does have creation ex nihilo, Vilenkin's model, but most of the others don't, right? You say they're all compatible with the Bible. So it seems to me that that is a contradiction, because if the Bible is clear that this is an absolute beginning of time and a creation ex nihilo, and you're also saying that models that we have in our book, for example, ones that collapse and then expand back out, that those are compatible with what you have in the Bible, then that's not creation ex nihilo. So it seems to me, maybe you can just clarify
you're raising a good point.
It seems like a contradiction.
Yeah, as you're probably aware, theologians debate extensively, what does the Bible mean by creation ex nihilo? Is it open to the fact that God could have created other time dimensions? I think it is. There's clearly some kind of beginning to the universe in which we live. And, you know, everything we observe in the universe seems to be tracing back to this beginning of the cooling of the universe, the beginning of physics that we can trust. But beyond that, again, Hebrews 11:3, the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. That opens up a lot of possibilities. Do we need to actually look more carefully at time? This conference we had at Cambridge, you know, one thing that we all agreed upon, since we're constrained to a single dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed, we can't precisely define time. And there's a lot of possibilities there. And so given our limitations on defining time, given the fact that the Bible seems to be quite clear that he's going to be creating other temporal realms independent of cosmic time, and he already has, I think we've got to be open to the kinds of possibilities you discuss in your book. And again, as I said, this is deja vu. You know, virtually every model you discuss, we discussed at the Cambridge conference.
So I don't know, I can have a couple of things. I don't feel, okay, so I just want to say, maybe we're getting to the close. So so I think there are kind of two things that are becoming clear to me. I mean, obviously you can't.
Hey folks, at this point, the stream broke its connection and we lost about 50 seconds, but Niyayesh gives a good summary of what he said during those 50 seconds.
Right. So I think I was just saying that it's a good thing that we put, I mean, Christianity in, at least not in conflict with science as it is, but try to read it in a way that is consistent with scientific understanding as is. What I do worry about this approach, but I think Hugh, you were going to confirm that you're also an advocate of that approach. So what I was going to kind of point out as a danger, potential danger in this approach, is that if we kind of read these too literally, we may put science or Christianity in a collision course with science somewhere down the line. For example, when you say that you predict humans are exceptional, or when you say laws of physics don't change, and I don't know, in 10 years or 100 years, we discover extraterrestrial life and we start to communicate with them, or we discover that laws of physics did change at some point in some way, then would they be excommunicated, the people who find this? Basically the same thing that happened to Galileo a few hundred years ago is going to happen to scientists who discovered this.
Yeah, good point. I've actually just submitted a paper to a peer-reviewed journal, Are We Humans Alone in the Universe?, making the point that Christian scholars have debated this for over 2,000 years. And you got Christians on both sides of the debate making the point, you know, God seems to enjoy creating. Certainly he's going to create beings like us on another planet. And so when we talk about human exceptionalism, from a Christian perspective, God created angels. They're also intelligent species, according to the Bible. Are we exceptional compared to the angels? The Bible would say yes, that there is a difference between angels and human beings. So again, exceptional in what ways would need to be defined? And I don't think that eliminates the possibility that God could have created intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. Although, and by the way, I cited your book in this paper because I thought, you know, this is something that actually would help about whether the one that created the universe, he made it so huge, could he have created places elsewhere? So, but I think the point you're raising is valid. If indeed Christianity is teaching that God gave us two trustworthy books that are both without error, the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture, and they are independent of one another in that they don't totally overlap, then that means that from a Christian perspective, if my interpretation of the Book of Scripture contradicts my interpretation of the Book of Nature, I know I've made an interpretive error. And I need to go back into the science, I need to go back into the theology and say, hey, have I understood something that's literal that shouldn't be understood as literal? Is there an anomaly here that needs to be pursued? And, you know, as I engage audiences of theologians and scientists, I basically tell them, we need to welcome anomalies, things that don't fit our interpretation, because that's the pathway to discovering things we don't know already. And again, I want to commend the two of you, because I think you really drove that point home in your book, that, hey, anomalies are not things that we shouldn't run away from. These are opportunities. And, hey, as we resolve an anomaly, if that resolution leads to more anomalies, well, it should, because we don't know everything. But if the new anomalies are less of a problem for us than the anomaly we've already resolved, that's an indication, not a proof, but an indication we're on the pathway to truth. And I think that's how theology should operate. It's how science should operate. And too often I see, both among scientists and theologians, they're running away from anomalies rather than welcoming them.
Okay, can I just ask you then, well, basically, let me put it this way. I've seen a lot of your talks and I've read your books, and you're very, very strong that the Big Bang has proven that the universe had a beginning, an absolute beginning. We're not talking about an evolution from a hot, dense state. That's not what we're talking about. Obviously, that's what we think it says, right? But in your work, you're very, very clear that no, it's an absolute beginning of time, right? Now, the conversation that we've had tonight seems to me to imply that you don't actually think that, that you think, hey, if there's, you know, a model like the bouncing model that is compatible with the Bible, then the Bible can't be saying that it's an absolute beginning of time. So when you next speak to a popular audience, will you explain to them that when you said that the Big Bang has proven a beginning, you didn't really mean an absolute beginning of time? Because if that's true, then you're contradicting yourself with the compatibility with other models.
Yeah, I'm
so
not
will
sure
you say that to your
the,
audience?
I'm not ever sure I use the word absolute beginning of time, but I have talked about the beginning of time, and I'm not sure what edition. I mean, notice I've written now 4 editions of The Creator and the Cosmos. I'm working on a 5th edition, and every time I keep making minor adjustments, basically to make sure we're clarifying things. I have to fight the editors because they say, hey, lay people aren't going to be interested in all these caveats. But I appreciate, for example, what I see in your book is something I'm going to be using in the next edition, saying, hey, this needs to be clarified a little more. But the basic theme of the book, I think, is correct. And who knows, I might be coming up with a 6th edition of the book. So,
well, wasn't that your criteria? Like you said, there were 3 criteria, and wasn't it the first one was that there's a cosmic creation event, an absolute beginning of time. Like, let me put it this way. You said, like, when you talked about scalar field models or loop quantum gravity models, and you were critical of them, right? You said they don't avoid the singularity theorems, right? But that's not true, is it? I mean, like, the Cuskaton model doesn't have a singularity. That's a good example, right? String gas cosmology doesn't have a singularity. But you say quite clearly these singularity theorems have been proven. They are no longer in question. They're your very words, Hugh. So are you going to tell your audience that they are now in question?
You're probably looking at an older edition. The 4th edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, I was very careful in stating exactly where we can nail down this beginning of the universe. So I think if you read the 4th edition, you'll see the caveats that you want. They're in there. And that was 2018, so they've been there for
quite a while. People would have read the 1st edition. They would have seen your lectures. They would have seen your talks, right? And the question is, will you say something to them, like on your website, and say something like, you know, I was wrong to give you the impression that these singularity theorems have been proven, that they're no longer in doubt? Because if you just make an amendment to it, to something, and you don't sort of tell your audience that you were wrong to say it, then that's very misleading.
Reassuring. In my talks, I'm actually making those statements. I've been doing that for the past several years, saying, hey, how far can we go with this? For example, I've been making talks on quantum gravity, saying, hey, what's really interesting is we now have observations of gamma ray sources that are actually able to probe, not a lot, but they're actually probing inside the quantum gravity era. And what does this say about the space-time theorems? Well, it actually says a little bit more than what we had, say, in the Guth, Blinken, Borde theorem. So we're actually able to push a little bit more. And that extra push is compatible with the Christian faith. It's not going along with what we see from people like Sean Carroll. Again, we cannot prove this in an absolute sense. So I would avoid the word absolute. I'm making that point. Often I use the analogy, even though I've been married for 48 years, I don't have absolute proof that my wife exists. All I have is a very high probability. But the probability gets higher with every year that we spend together as husband and wife. And likewise, we're never going to be able to get the physics that'll take us all the way back to the beginning. There will always be a region where people can speculate. And we're never going to eliminate that. But I think the one way we can test the models, and something I appreciate about your book, we do the possibility of probing a little more than we've done already. We're never going to learn everything about the universe, but we are going to learn more. And as we learn more, we're going to be able to determine which philosophical models survive and which ones don't. And I've got a whole chapter in The Creator and the Cosmos, fourth edition, where I talk about absolute proof versus practical proof, where I kind of make the caveats that you are actually requiring. You know, and that's a fairly long chapter in the book. I think you'd enjoy taking a look at that. And so I am committed, as time goes on, to keep making those kinds of improvements and caveats without offending the lay reader, because after a while it gets a bit tedious. And a lot of it I put online saying, hey, if you really want this at a level where you can engage people like Niyesh and Phil, go to this article here. I give it to you in all of its gory detail.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I mean, I think that this is great that, I mean, you're updating the book according to kind of the best understanding. I'd be happy. I'm sure there would be other practicing cosmologists and physicists who kind of go over your manuscript and make sure that they are in accordance with kind of our understanding of science as it is, because as you know, things evolve very rapidly. And sometimes, I mean, reading the articles don't exactly, they don't exactly mean, and there are a lot of nuances. So that translating to the lay audience language could become misleading. So I think that this is great. And I just wanted to say, I don't really have much else. The other thing I just wanted to say that it's there's a lot of imagination and wonder that we have in common, but both in theology and in science. But then what we do with that in terms of what we call Feynman's straitjacket, which is basically we want to make prediction and test them against the data. It seems that that's where we diverge, in the sense that we, as I pointed out, when our predictions turn out to be inconsistent with the real world, we throw out our theories and we go to find new ones. But then where your predictions turn out to be inconsistent with the real world, you just change the interpretation. And I think, I mean, that's fine. Maybe that's the way these things are supposed to be. But I think it's important for us to make sure that the science and religion kind of don't go into conflict with each other, because that would be much more catastrophic. And I think I hope we are all on the same page in that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate those statements, Niyesh. So thank you.
Thank you.
And just so you're aware, we do have our books peer reviewed by people like yourself. But we also have to fight the editors who are trying to make sure it's still lay accessible. They mm-hmm. often say, well, put it online, don't put it in the book. So that's going on. And we're revising our website. We're actually going to have the original articles, but show how it's evolved with respect to time. And it's all in one document, so people can see the evolution as we learn more about the theology, as we learn more about the science. I think that's going to satisfy a lot of the suggestions that the two of you are making.
Thanks.
Well, that's good. I mean, I hope you might do something also like, well, let's just take this claim that you made about complex inflation, right? You said that complex inflation was evidence of God, and that we had evidence for complex inflation from NS equals 0.965. Now, the audience might not know what NS is. It doesn't really matter. The point is, there's a number. You say it should have this value if your theory is right. And then you said that inflation with NS over 1, with NS greater than 1, inflation is ruled out. And that just seems wrong. We listed these four mistakes that you make, right, in your book.
No,
so would you correct those mistakes?
I think I will, because, I mean, I was citing a paper that was basically saying, hey, given our understanding of inflation at this point, these are the numbers we would have. So yes, based on what you say, I would change that. I think what
evidence for God, right, which presumably upped your credence that God existed. So now we're in agreement that there is a mistake. Would your credence in God go down at all? Because if you have the evidence pointed to it, and that was no good.
The point I was making is you need something like inflation to get the universe as big as it is in the short time that has existed.
Well, what do you mean, like? Can I just clarify what you mean by like inflation? What do you mean by like inflation?
Well, you need some mechanism to get the universe as large as it is, with the galaxies as far apart as they are, and still have it all thermally connected. And you point out, hey, inflation is a straightforward way to do it, but there's other ways to make that happen as well.
Right.
So that's something I'm going to be including in my future writings, is making it clear. And hey, I think one point I saw you make, Nyesh, is there's a model that actually predicted the scalar spectral index to four places the decimal. You know, as I read that, I said, I wonder how many other models would give you the same number. And so would it be a prediction? And also, having talked to the people that are making measurements of the scalar spectral index, they're not holding on a lot of hope that they're going to get the measurement accurate to five places the decimal. So that may be an impractical test. But I was just curious. I mean, what are the range of models? What kind of predictions do they make? And how much money and effort should we be putting into this? And what's it going to tell us about the universe? That's why I made the suggestion. Maybe where we get more bang for the buck is looking at the Hubble tension, looking at black hole populations and characteristics, looking at what's going on in the center of our galaxy. That may give us a little more bang for the buck on trying to, narrow the scope of these models. And I think the success of your book is that, hey, we're now learning enough where we used to have a huge family of Big Bang models. That family is getting more and more narrowly defined, but it's still a really big family. And I think it always will be. No matter how narrowly defined we get it, it's still going to be a really big family, which tells me that people like you, Nyesh, will never be unemployed.
That's that music to my ears. Thank you for suggesting that. Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, no, go, James. Did you want to go to questions?
This might be a good opportunity. But I do want to say, if you had any last thoughts, we could even give both sides maybe a couple of minutes if you have any additional thoughts. But otherwise, this is a fine time to go into the Q&A as well.
I just wanted to say I have to probably leave in a few minutes because I timed all the delays that we had. So, I don't have any more to add.
That makes sense. Understandable. We're going to jump into these questions then.
Let me make one point, and that is when Christians get together in these issues, we realize the issue of the beginning is a place where it's going to be difficult to make much progress scientifically, but where we're probably going to get a lot more fruit is what you see in the writings of Thomas Aquinas. It's the fine-tuning of the universe that has the greatest potential for showing the integration of science with theology. And so that's probably where we need to spend more of our debate and the research time.
But that's a whole nother topic.
It is a whole nother topic.
I'm just saying, that's kind of where Christian discussion's going. Yeah. I think just my summing up thoughts is that, I think when you read Q's works and when you see his lectures, you get this very strong sense that, the Big Bang has proven that the universe had a beginning, and that proves the Bible and God. And now it seems that we're hearing something different. And I hope that in future talks, those caveats about whether the Big Bang really was a beginning will be made clear. And maybe we can sing as one that actually we really don't know if the universe had a beginning or not.
I'm already on record as saying it's some kind of cosmic beginning. So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to Q&A then.
You got it. And folks, our guests are linked in the description box. Highly encourage, even if you disagree, there's a lot of value from reading someone's position straight from them rather than hearing a summary of it from someone else, especially if it's someone kind of within your own camp. There's a lot of value reading it directly from them. So even if you disagree, check out our guest links. We do appreciate them being here with us. We have actually two questions, and these are not super related, to be honest, but I do want to give you a chance in case you wanted to ask. Well, this is more closely related. So this one's on target. Basil Problem said, Phil, how do quote, big crunch
cosmological models reconcile the early universe's low entropy?
Right, as well, there's many different approaches that you can take to that. One is to say the entropy of the universe was infinite, so it was always infinite. So if there was a collapsing universe and an expanding one, that, yeah, you might think that violates the second law, but not necessarily, because the universe could, the entropy could be infinite. There are lots of different ideas here. Some of that the entropy would somehow reset as you go from one to the other. But I think a bigger picture is that the low entropy condition at the Big Bang is a mystery to any model of the universe. So if you put that low entropy state in the middle of, let's say, an hourglass universe, or if you put it at the beginning of a beginning universe, it's mysterious either way. So I don't think it really, however you solve that riddle of the low entropy condition, it doesn't really speak for one model versus another. In fact, you might argue that an eternal universe has a chance to explain why the entropy was low at the Big Bang. And then there are lots of different proposals. Alan Guth just came out with one. Well, I say just came out with one. I've been working on it for years, but he's going to be publishing soon, I believe. He just gave a lecture at Johns Hopkins. But there's all kinds of ideas. So it doesn't really threaten that kind of model.
You got it. And this other question comes from Basil as well. Said, Dr. Ross, if your wife was a simulation, why would her probability of existence increase over time?
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. I mean, maybe I've been fooled by a three-dimensional holographic image for all these years. That's a possibility I can't totally rule out absolutely. But the fact that I can do experiments on her, I can make observations, I can look at the observations and experiments that others have done with her. What I notice is it seems like the case scientifically that she's a real physical living being as opposed to some kind of holographic image. That evidence is getting stronger and stronger with respect to time. But I can't claim I got absolute proof for the existence of my wife, just like I can't claim I got absolute proof for the existence of God, or even absolute proof that the universe is a real physical entity. We humans can't come up with absolute proof of anything, but we can come up with probabilities.
You got it. That's actually it for questions. I do want to mention, folks, is that if you just tuned in let's say, the last 30 minutes or so, the stream did disconnect at one point. And so we actually have two kind of video pieces. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to edit these back together. And so that it'll also have the summary of the 50 seconds that was cut, thanks to Niyesh. We appreciate that. And that way people will be able to see the whole debate as just one upload. So what I'm going to do is I'll set this video to private. And then within several hours, we'll see what the upload speed here at the hotel is. I'll upload the entirety of the debate. So it will still be here for the public. And check out our guest links, folks. They're the lifeblood of the channel. So do check out their links. We do appreciate them being with us today. It was a great discussion. It's encouraging that, you know, as we said before the debate, I'm encouraged that you guys had such a quality discussion, both in terms of the intellectual rigor, but also the mutual respect.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Yes.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, I've enjoyed this.
Thank you.
Hey, yeah, Bill, you may be interested in this with respect to your comment about Alan Guth.
Yeah, go ahead.
He consistently wins the most entropic office amongst
us. Oh, I know that. Yeah. Yeah, actually, we put that in our talks. Yeah, he won the messiest office in Boston award. Yeah, I've been in that office, so I can tell you how messy it is.
Yeah, I've seen photographs of it. It's quite remarkable.
It also seems to be sponsored by Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi. I can't remember which, but literally it's filled with Diet Cola drinks. Yeah.
Well, thanks, folks. I'll be back in a moment letting you know about upcoming debates. I'm going to let our guests go, but thanks again, gentlemen. I'll be back. Bye. Thanks for being with us, folks. Thrilled to have you here. Let me just load that Zoom window up again. It's very exciting stuff. So we are, as you can tell, I'm at the hotel right now, the venue from where we're going to have DebateCon 6, our sixth conference in person. It's very exciting stuff. But here's why, let me just load that video feed up. Here we go. Thanks for your patience. Here's why I'm very excited is If you are in the Nashville area, come on out. You can still grab a ticket. We can fit maybe a few more people. So if you're nearby, grab a ticket and we'll fit you in. It's going to be a cozy little squeeze because we've got about space for just over 200 people and those seats are going to be completely full. So we are very excited about this conference. If you are from far away and you're like, I can't make it, I highly encourage you. You can watch all of the debates at home with a Final Word membership. So I just put the link in the chat so you can check out the channel memberships. It's $14.99. You get to watch all of the debates. So it's about an average of $2.14 a debate. Piece of cake. Not only that, if you already have a channel membership, you can upgrade it for whatever the difference is and get to watch all of DebateCon 6. So highly encourage you, grab this opportunity. It's going to be a blast. You're going to love it. I want to say thank you guys for all your support. Actually, right now, I've got people from the hotel that have been asking me, like, hey, we need you to help us set up the room. So I do have to go, but I do want to say thank you guys for your support. This debate, as I mentioned, will be on private as I stitch the two debates together and then re-release it. But I want to say thank you guys for being with us. And I'm looking forward to seeing you at the next debate. You guys have a great rest of your night or day, wherever you are. And I just appreciate your support of Modern Day Debate. Thank you, guys, and I'll see you soon.
We've all done it. Stock our fridge with good intentions, only to sacrifice nutrition for convenience. Keep your body and mind nourished with whole body meal shakes from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But it actually tastes delicious. Try one of Kachava's indulgent flavors today. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS. That's KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.